Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925. The first and finest enameled cast iron cookware and a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're looking at the way labels shape our perspectives on food.
I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but is it acceptable to judge a wine by its label?
There are some labels that I'd say are so bad they're good.
As long as your paperwork's in good shape, you'll get a grass-fed label.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Allie Kane. Welcome to In the Sauce, a new podcast about building food brands. When we launched a line of fresh sauces for grocery stores last year, I knew we were jumping into something crazy. Haven's Kitchen is a cooking school, cafe, and event space. Learning the world of CPG and grocery has been a massive learning experience. In my efforts to get myself educated, I started meeting everyone I know and respect who could advise me on everything from production and distribution to legal, PR, and social media. And then I started having those conversations here as a podcast so that every other entrepreneur can learn from them as well. This is the story of Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Amy Stern, Director of Operations of Chloe's Fruit, a national frozen snack food brand. Chloe's Fruit Pops can be found in 10,000 grocery stores across the country, and they produce tens of millions of pops a year.
That's correct.
Welcome, Amy.
Thank you so much.
So I like to start these discussions off, and I don't know why I chose fourth grade, but for some reason, I feel like fourth grade is when we're sort of like forming an identity of some sort, and like all of a sudden you kind of have something you want to be when you grow up in fourth grade that's not like an ice cream truck driver, which, by the way, would be fine if that's what you were into. But what did you want to be when you were in fourth grade?
Oh, gosh, fourth grade. I want to say veterinarian. Yeah, my dad was a doctor, is a doctor. And I guess I wanted to blend the little girl loving animals with that medical field. So, yeah, veterinarian.
Did you pursue science in any way? Because you do have an EMT.
So the veterinarian then kind of merged into wanting to just go into a medical field. And I went to University of Florida. I grew up in South Florida. And my plan was to become something in the medical field, but I didn't know what. And my dad definitely didn't want me to be a doctor. He was very against that, but kind of left everything else open.
Right.
And I couldn't figure it out. So I got a business degree. I figured that's applicable.
Yeah, we're gonna go into that for a second because you have an interesting, I read your bio. There's like an EMT.
Yeah.
You baked for a while.
Yep.
You were in finance.
I was, yeah.
And I feel like there's one other.
And I worked at a hospital doing management.
Yes. Yeah. So you're a multi-hyphenate.
I am a career jumper, maybe. Yeah.
Well, you stayed in one place for several years now.
So, I have now, yeah.
So you got your, you went to college and did you study medicine at college?
I did. So I was in a program where I was able to do two different concentrations at the same time. So I did business, but I specialized in health science in the business school. And right from there, went to EMT school.
Right.
The idea being, dip your toe in.
See
how you feel.
Very smart. And you didn't feel it.
I didn't feel it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's intense, no? I mean, not that operations isn't intense, because I actually feel like
Yeah, it's intense in a different kind of way, like a life-saving kind of way.
Pops save lives.
They
right?
definitely yeah. save mm-hmm. lives. I think I thought it was going to be like TV. Like we were going to run up and there was going to be a car on fire and I was going to drag them out and perform CPR. And it was nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing like that at all.
So you were like, I'm out and I'm going to go to business school.
Well, so I moved to New York from there and took that sort of business degree, the undergrad degree with a little smattering of health knowledge.
Right.
And I started working at Beth Israel in their orthopedic department.
Oh, cool.
But I managed their orthopedic group.
Okay.
And did that for a couple years. And that is when I jumped and both went into finance. I started working in hedge funds.
Right.
Just a total change up.
I love to all you children out there, it's okay.
If you decide in the fourth grade that you want to be a veterinarian, you can change your mind a lot. And at the same time, I went to business school at NYU. I was in their part-time program, the STERM program, actually.
Right.
And I did that simultaneously. So I was both working in a hedge fund, doing what's called management accounting, kind of boring stuff there, and going to school part-time.
And then did you always like food? Were you always a food person or was that like nervous breakdown food time?
No.
You went to go be a baker?
No, I always.
Because people either do one or the other. They're like, I always wanted to be in it and I didn't know I could have a career in it. Or like, no, I just kind of like burnt out and lost my shit and had to start baking. And it's either one or the other.
No, I was always very into baking. I was never good at cooking.
You're a science person.
Yeah. I think my first cookbook was something like How to Boil Water.
Yep.
But I was always really into baking. And after being in hedge funds for however many years, I did just burn out on it and decided just clean break. I wanted to do something totally different. And I think I found an ad on maybe Craigslist.
Right.
Looking for an intern at a bakery. It's City Cakes, which actually right by, by Haven's Kitchen and by our Chloe's office. And went in, no experience at all. And they said, come on in, we'll teach you how to bake.
Right. And so you started baking. You were doing nothing at that point with your finance, anything. You were just baking.
Just baking cookies.
And then how did Chloe's find you?
So Chloe's found me. I went to college at University of Florida with our CFO, Todd Hoffman. Mm-hmm. And one day, a couple of years into working in the bakery, he gave me a call. He said, I know you've got an accounting background.
Right.
We could use some help doing just payroll, pay some bills, you know, nothing full time, couple hours a week. And I would come in straight from the bakery, covered in like red velvet, bring a couple of cookies, process payroll, pay some bills, and that was it. That was my kind of lead into the Chloe's world.
And so from my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but from my understanding, they opened two shops.
Yes.
They opened one on the Upper East Side, and then they opened the one that we all know in Union Square.
Correct, yep.
And the plan was or was not go into CPG? Was it always kind of in the back of their head, or were they like, oh, it was sort of like me in the sense that it started as very much a retail brick and mortar concept and then turned into something that they saw as a product that was scalable?
Yeah, it started, like you said, with the two stores. The one on the Upper East Side was the first store, Union Square, where we still have our flagship stores there. And the idea originally was to be like a frozen yogurt shop. To be like the new, you know,
Tasty Delight, but fruit,
everything be fruit-based, banana-based at the time. Mm-hmm. And Chloe's was going on a TV show, and they wanted her to present something new on the show. So a chef that was working with us at the time bought some pop molds, stuck the mix into the mold, froze them, put a pop stick inside it, and said, here you go, we make pops now.
Wow.
Which we didn't.
Right.
And so she went on TV, presented these Chloe's pops, and the next day we got a call from a summer camp up on the Upper East Side, and they wanted 1,000 pops.
Right.
And so we had to figure out how to make them. And that just all kind of snowballed from there.
And were you there during that time?
I wasn't. That was right before I started.
So when you got there, you were still basically doing payroll for the brick and mortars.
Right. Yep.
And then, but now you are the head of operations for a pop company that makes millions, tens of millions of pops a year in 10,000 stores.
Right.
So how did that happen? Like, when, first of all, at some point you were like, I'm going to stop baking.
Well, right? I mean, really the opposite happened, where I came in and said, guys, I don't think there's anything left for me to do here. I've got you like caught up on your paperwork. I've got you caught up on payroll. And they said, wait a second, what do you think about running our operations? And I said, I don't know what that means.
So this is awesome, because you had to figure out everything like we did. Like, you had to figure out co-packers and freight and distribution networks and brokers and all of that.
Yeah.
Fun, fun stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And luckily, you know, I said, I don't know how to do it. They said, we don't know how to do it.
Right.
We'll figure it out together. And, you know, we'd Google what things meant. We just really had no idea, but we were working from the ground up. And so what happened during that time is Chloe's got into a grocery store chain, got into HEB in Texas.
That's like how many stores?
It's a couple hundred.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big first customer.
Exactly. Yeah. And things just went from there. It just totally, everything took the turn from that whole, you know, frozen yogurt idea to we're a CPG brand.
Right.
We are a popsicle brand. And everything exploded.
And the way that now, I mean, because my, you know, I didn't have any big CPG plans. I really just wanted to teach people how to cook. And now the way I see it is, in a few years, hopefully the sauce business will be basically paying in some way for the brick and mortar. Like, the brick and mortar will almost be like our marketing flagship for the sauce business. Is that kind of how it is for you guys? Like, does the brick and mortar exist at this point to support? Is there a correlation, and is it used as like a way to support the CPG, or do you kind of run them separately? Or
so they're run separately. You know, the brick and mortar stores run as its own standalone, but it is, at least in the past, its primary purpose was to be able to say to a buyer, come into our store, see what Chloe's, the brand, is. It's the best way to represent your brand is to say, here's a store where everything is Chloe's, and we're representing it in the best way possible.
That is really helpful for me, because it is, it's like what we always call like the like experiential manifestation of the brand. Like, you walk into Havens and you know exactly who we are and what we stand for, and then you have a better idea of what these pouches are that are now going to be in your store.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Well, I have a lot of questions.
Okay.
We're going to take a little break. And when we get back, we're going to get into like supply chain and operations and logistics and hiring and all sorts of
exciting
stuff.
All right.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, the first to pioneer colorful enameled cookware over 90 years ago. They've been a favorite for generations through the meals and memories the cookware creates and the style it expresses. My name is Kat Johnson. I'm the communications director at Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food, and my favorite cookware is the 8-quart marine blue Dutch oven that never leaves my stovetop. Before we got our Le Creuset, the cookware we used most often was an antique Griswold cast iron pan. It didn't take long for me to realize how much I'd been missing enamel cast iron in my life. Le Creuset has the superior heat retention of cast iron, but paired with the unparalleled performance and ease of enamel. That means delicious food with easy cleanup. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN, that's LECREUSET, .com/HRN to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
Hi, I'm Allie, and I'm back with Amy Stern, Director of Operations at Chloe's Fruit. So now that you're making, I just like saying, tens of millions of pops a year, how do you define head of operations?
You know, somebody that used to work for us used to say that I make the pops and I move the pops.
Make the pops and move the pops. Yeah. So everything until selling the pops?
Well, so even that, little bit, I don't do the actual sales, but I get our product from our warehouse to the distributor's warehouse. So
how many so can you tell me a little bit about your supply chain? Because you're national distribution, right? Do you have one co-packer or do you have more than one?
Right now we have two co-packers.
Okay. And then, so are they fairly systemized or is there a lot of management of them?
There's actually both of them started this year and really one just within the past few months. So while the idea, of course, is for them to be just automated and run on their own, we're not there yet.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just a nervous Nelly, but at the end of the day, it's still your product. As much as you love and trust your co-packer, which I think is important, clearly, I don't know that it ever, I remember Jesse last week was like, people have to stop saying when I get my ducks in a row, because your ducks are never going to be in a row. I'm not sure that as the company, you're ever going to be completely comfortable with someone making it. You can trust them and you don't have to be there for every production run and whatever.
Right. But they're not wearing a Chloe's t-shirt when they're there. They're wearing their own company shirt.
Right.
And we want them to want to love our product and get everything perfectly right. But
yeah,
that's a lot of trust.
So do you go to the two different production facilities and watch the runs or?
Yeah, myself or someone else on our team. So our CFO helps out with production. Mm-hmm. And then we have a food scientist that we use as a consultant who helps create all of our recipes. He does a lot of our R&D.
Right.
So he'll go out and, join us to make sure that, I can say, gosh, this doesn't taste exactly right.
Right. But and he'll be able to say it's the 10 seconds of whatever.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you're also you're doing procurement for all of the ingredients.
Right. Yep.
So you have how many, would you say, different suppliers for all the different ingredients that you're managing?
Let's say we have 9 SKUs right now, so probably at least 9 suppliers across those SKUs. There's some, crossover between
strawberries.
Them. Right, yeah. Right. But, some of them are just a standalone fruit that we're buying.
And I think one of the, we're looking right now at, we're doing this sight line thing where this sounds very, I sound like I'm 8, but it's actually really cool where I'm sort of looking at the margins per SKU right now and then doing this flying brick chart where, mm-hmm. You're getting 10% here and you're getting 10% there, as you sort of bring efficiencies and make your ingredients less expensive, et cetera. Right. But did you know when you were sort of getting into this, did you negotiate good terms with these different suppliers? Have you found ways to bring down the costs of your ingredients? Are you constantly looking at the margins and trying to improve them on each SKU? I don't know. How do you even figure it out, right?
So in the beginning, when I came in, I sort of took on the vendors that we were already using, mm-hmm. sort of had the historical ones. And when we were getting our feet under us, we weren't looking at those costs so much. We were thrilled that we were getting a product out there.
And that's how we are right now.
Right. And there was a wide range between those 9 SKUs, mm-hmm. what's a moneymaker by itself and what is something that maybe we're willing to lose a couple of cents on, mm-hmm. because it tastes great and it's going to sell well. And mm-hmm. that'll help push those other products. Just now, and now the company started in about 2010, we're in 2019, mm-hmm. and we're really just now starting to get that real push to say, we need to make all of this more profitable, and how do we do it? But a lot of that comes from, we've been selling the pops for 5 years, and mm-hmm. we've grown so much, so we have a little more power behind us to say, okay, we're not just buying a drum or 2 drums, we're going to buy 20 truckloads mm-hmm. of your product and probably more. What are you going to do to help us do that?
Right. And I remember when we had Derek Quant, who's COO at Bonza, on, mm-hmm. he was like, you should always get 90 or 120 day terms. And we're like,
wait, we get like four. Right. They're like, they're worried we're going to go away. So yeah. They're like, you need to actually pay us right now, you know? And we're like, how do we even get those, you know? So we feel like, you know, the good news is that we know that there's a sight line,
right?
You know, I mean, we know that it is really inefficient and really expensive right now to make everything. But the goal obviously is to, you know.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, Derek's point with that, with the terms is, you know, part of the problem with the company, you know, the type of things we do is we're buying the fruit and then paying for the production and then you're paying for storage and then you're finally selling something to a company that has terms.
Right.
So the money that goes out is so far spread from the money that comes back in. So like to Derek's point, the better terms you can get, that really helps
the more cash you can hold on to. Do you feel like, I mean, clearly in that sense, your finance background has been helpful. Do you find that the way that you think about things is sort of influenced by the business degree, or do you feel like maybe it's been more sort of learned on the job and more about the just the personality type that can manage this type of logistics situation?
I think it's more of what I've learned, not even just on the job, but just throughout my career. I think so much of the bartering, the give and take between two companies, everyone's trying to get to a place where they're comfortable, where, you know, the vendor's charging a certain amount, but you're paying a certain amount. And yeah, there's a lot of finance behind that, but a lot of it to me is the relationship.
Right.
That if you've got
you're not the first person that said that.
Yeah. That, you know, if you've got somebody that you want to work with, they want to work with you, there are ways to figure it out.
Right.
Right.
So a couple things in terms of supply chain, right? Like as we're building ours and refining it and as we're planning new SKUs and stuff like that, I'd love just a couple of things that you would like to tell yourself 5 years ago. Like, what do you think would have made it easier for you if you had known? Or any advice? Because the majority of the people that listen to this podcast are people either at my stage or even a little earlier. And we're all just trying to figure it out. And anything that we can do to sort of like skip over one of those learning steps that takes 6 months and then, you know, and then you get under your belt and you know it. It'd be great if there's just anything you can give us.
Yep. For me, you know, our product is a fruit product and the knowledge of the fruit world, you know, it's sort of, there's this, you know, infinite amount of information out there, but the basics, if I had kind of gone from the beginning and looked at the basics, taken a wheel of when fruit harvests and what forms it harvests into. So you take something simple like a strawberry and say, okay, there's the actual, you know, strawberry that goes to the consumer on their table. They eat a whole fruit. From there, there's, you know, frozen, then there's purees, there's juices, that whole line, but also when all those fruits are harvested. So when we plan a new SKU, we're not just saying like, you know, whatever, lemon tastes delicious, let's just buy a lemon and we'll make a new lemon SKU. But we know going into it, like, this is when lemons are harvested.
Right.
So if we're going to be buying it, this is when we need to know about the fruit. And
that's really great advice because like an intimate, deep knowledge of every single ingredient.
Right. It's something that we came across. We had a huge problem with this year with pomegranate. So who would have known anything about pomegranate?
Right.
I never would have thought it was a SKU we'd even run. But we launched it last year, really, you know, small takeoff. And then all of a sudden it kind of exploded and we were way behind.
There's like a run on pomegranates.
Well, and so who knew pomegranates are harvested now, basically. Right. They're a late fall fruit. And we use both a concentrate and a single strength juice, but the vendors mostly just make concentrate. So trying to find that single strength became this impossible task because we were looking for it in the middle of summer.
Right.
And no one had any left. So now I know right now I am contracted for 2019 on pomegranate. I'm good. Vendor that we buy from has packed it for us. because the problems we had this past year with, we had the pomegranate shortage of 2018.
So that's very cool. So when you picture a SKU, do you picture it like in an Excel with like every ingredient in that SKU and then sort of what you need to do for that ingredient and make sure that you have that ingredient? And, you know, is that how your brain is picturing it?
Not necessarily in Excel. I think about it in terms of like every part of that, like the buying it. Is it something that we've never bought before and we're going to have to figure that whole process out? Mm-hmm. All of the certifications we get, you know, everything is gluten-free. It's kosher. It's non-GMO. So are we starting from zero on all of those things? And then the same, do we understand the market for this fruit at all?
Right.
You know?
Have you ever thought of, like, has there ever been, like, a SKU that you haven't done because for some reason or another it's just an unreasonable fruit to put in a pop?
Yeah. we cannot get pumpkin. Pumpkin, it's the bane of our...
I don't feel like I'm missing that.
Right.
Just no. I mean, like, I feel like the other, how many SKUs are there? Nine.
Yeah, we're good.
Yeah. I don't know. So pumpkin pop doesn't rock my world.
And maybe not as a pop, but we still do have the store that does soft serve.
Yes. And that would be great.
Right. And we do have it, but we can't sell it as a wholesale product. We use in our store, we use canned Libby's. When you can a fruit like that, there's a heating process that in a way it cooks the fruit a little bit.
Right.
And it's cooking the pumpkin and you get that cooked slightly pumpkin cooked taste that you want.
Yeah.
And if you're buying it wholesale to use at a co-packer, it's raw pumpkin puree.
Right.
It tastes like raw pumpkin puree.
That's fascinating.
I've tasted all of them.
Right.
And we just couldn't do it.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so now when you started, basically they were like, okay, you're going to do operations. And you're like, okay. And there were how many SKUs at that time?
Five, I believe.
And did you have anyone supporting you on supply chain or any of that? No, it was just you.
Yeah.
And now, 5 years later, with several more SKUs and tens of millions of pops a year, how many, like, what does your team look like?
I am still my team. So there's been some change. We had a consultant in the beginning who helped a lot with setting up the co-packers that we were using at the time.
Right.
And as he's transitioned out, our CFO actually transitioned into helping a lot with that. But with all those co-packers comes a lot more ease of my job.
Yeah.
So instead of going, at least going forward, we have all these fruits set up, we're contracted, we're good. We won't be in charge of that anymore. That will become their job. And I'll be more, hopefully, theoretically, a higher level overview of that whole thing. So instead of manhandling every step of the way, the purchase, the transportation.
You can just say, hi, we need 5 million pops here and they go.
Yeah.
So that's a good question because I think a lot of people at the beginning, you know, I think a lot of us come with this sort of artisanal, we want to make it, we want to control it. Right. Maybe we'll build a facility and then we actually see what that would cost to build a facility. So then we all sort of go in search of a co-manufacturer / co-packer. What are the, would you say, like, are the absolute red flags when you're meeting potential co-packers to make your food? And what are some things that you were looking for that you found in these two that you sought out and found?
Yeah. So, I mean, red flags, you know.
Aside from, like, vermin.
Right. Well, so all of our, I think, you know, across the board, everyone's looking for something that's, you know, it's FSQF. Right. They're, you know, whatever level, or level three.
So just for all you listeners, SQF is like a food safety rating three is the highest.
Exactly. Yeah. And, we're also, like we said, we're gluten-free.
Right.
We're not just kosher, but we're kosher parv. So we're going into an ice cream manufacturer, but saying we need to be able to be made in a way.
There's no dairy anywhere near it.
Exactly.
And the certifications come from the co-packer, not from you. I mean, obviously you're purchasing non-GMO ingredients and gluten-free ingredients, but for the certifications, like on the box, those come from the co-packer?
So it depends on the certification. Right. So for the gluten, the kosher, the non-GMO, that's actually coming from our side.
Got
because
it.
It's certifying
the ingredient.
The ingredient, the product that we're making.
Right.
Now, the plant itself also has to be certified. So
right.
that, again, is a red flag when you say, we need to make something that hits all of these marks.
Mm-hmm.
And they come back and say, we won't do that.
Right.
Obviously, you have a problem. And we, with the co-packers we have, they didn't have those certifications, but worked with us
right.
to get those certifications.
Which is going to be helpful for them, too, right. going forward, right?
Right. So the one that is them is organic. So we do an organic product.
Right.
That's based on the plant. So the plant itself actually has the certification.
Right.
And then it's our ingredients, our product, but it's their name
right.
on that certification.
Got it. Okay, and other things you're looking for or looking really not for?
Other things we're looking for, I mean, we want to be there. We want to be able to say, look, we don't just want a meeting to talk about, you know, what we're going to do. We want to come and see your plant and meet your team. And
right.
are they open to that?
Right.
And what's the growth look like? You know, do they have room not just for the production, the million pops we're going to make this year, but do they have a growth plan for us? Do they have room for the 2 million we're going to make next year and the 10 million we're going to make the year after that? What are
right.
they doing to invest in that and invest back in us as a company?
Right. I think a lot of the people that are, you know, my size and smaller, our issues tend to be like trying to convince them that we're going to get enough volume to make it worth their while.
Right.
You know, and that's always like, look, you know, people like us and this retailer said that he might be interested, you know, and then you like make these projections and,
right.
you know, half of them feel a little bit, you know, they're projections. So sometimes I'm like, this seems like we're whipping this out of wherever. But, you know, on the other hand, like it does look like this is going to be what it is.
Right.
You know? So, okay. And what about, so you said that you are the team.
Yes.
So you don't have like a supply chain manager or anyone. So it is you basically making sure all of the ingredients get to where they need to be.
Yep.
And then making sure that it is produced in a timely way, making sure that it is then freighted to the 10,000 stores.
Right. Yep.
The way that it should be.
Yeah.
So that's a lot. I mean, yeah. what isn't your job? I mean, sales.
Sales. Well, sales and most importantly, customer service.
Right.
That's not my world
no,
at all.
I feel like, but you seem like you could be very good at it.
Yeah.
And so what's the worst, like what's like the, oh my gosh, what happened that was like that moment?
Well, the worst thing that's ever happened. We
yes.
so we're frozen pop,
right?
Obviously.
Needs to be frozen.
We ship at generally -10, -20 degrees, and we've had unfortunately not just once, but multiple trucks going into Costco,
mm-hmm.
which nobody wants to mess with Costco
right.
or have anything
Don't
go
mess
wrong.
With Costco.
We've had trucks melt, just completely melt, and
oh no,
we add a co-packer that's making an organic product, and their line time is filled,
right?
And an organic fruit that is when we're producing it, we're producing usually late winter.
Mm-hmm.
But the pack season is in the summer, so the
right.
fruit is maybe gone.
Right, you
at
can't
that
get
point.
The fruit, and if you got it, you'd have to pay for a whole new thing too.
You know, right, and there's the timing. It's coming from California. You know, this was
yeah.
our issue this year. It's coming from California. It's a frozen product that takes weeks to unfreeze, and then our co-packer needs the line time to be able to run it.
Right.
And then we have to say, hey, Costco, we can make this for you again.
Right.
2 months from now when pop season's basically over.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
and
like,
then hope that they don't ding us
right.
for next season.
Right. Oy. And then on our last minute,
yeah.
what advice do you have for people who are starting off or 5 years ago or, you know, this is a... this is a slog for sure. And there are just so many pieces of the puzzle and they all have to be kind of like perfectly calibrated. But
right.
it seems like you really have built a kick-ass supply chain, which is what I am titling the episode. So what is just some, like, a piece of advice or, you know, what do you want us to keep in mind? I mean, someone literally was like, you know, take care of yourself and do yoga. I mean, it doesn't have to be business related.
Yeah.
But just some advice to your, you know, earlier self.
Yeah, you
or
know,
me.
Or to you. Or Katie. I mean, for me, I think it's really the building relationships.
And right, that's great.
I can call, you know, a vendor, a fruit vendor or a freight vendor. And, you know, it seems like it's a little silly sometimes, but if you have that personal relationship with them, if you know, mm-hmm. you know, you can just call them and kind of, you know, have a conversation that's not related to whatever you're doing, just right. to say hi, check in. Then when you need them later, mm-hmm. they're much more likely to be there for you. So right. we've got vendors that, you know, they bend over backwards to try to find product for us.
Right.
Or they'll work, you know, a freight vendor who works on the weekends when things go wrong because, you know, he knows that that vendor is going to be my vendor for that fruit. I'm not going right. to switch from them, or I'm not going to switch from this freight vendor. I trust them. So they go out of their way to help. And it
awesome.
Just, it eases the stress of something yeah. so much when you can say, this is the guy taking care of it. And I know he's going to get it for
right.
us.
That's nice. That's yeah. good advice. Okay. I know I'm out of time, but I do want to just ask, freight, when you're building it into your cost of goods, is it like a 10% of, or is it 12, like frozen, I would imagine, is similar to refrigerated.
Yeah. So we try to make it 10%.
It's more like 12.
It's going up. It's really, it's 14, it's 15, it's going up, it's going
wow.
higher and higher. And that, I'm sure, is a whole nother episode for you.
Yes.
But yeah, that a lot of, you know, the gas prices going up and shipping shortages.
And the
shortages.
Rules around people being able to take breaks and take shifts.
Right.
And, you
yeah.
know, it's actually good for the people on the highways,
right.
but it's not great for the prices
no, yeah.
of our freight. Okay. On that note, I just want to say thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Jeet, thank you so much for being the engineer today. Matt, we missed you. And we will see you next time on In the Sauce.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.